Hello, word lovers, balladists, sonnetists, and poets and poetesses of all stripes. I am Brooke, and I'm here with my fellow lyricist, Grant Faulkner, as we continue to steam train into this brand new season with some truly exciting guests. So, hello, Grant.
Hey there, Brooke.
Today we have Jacqueline Woodson. I'm so excited. She's been setting the literary world on fire for the past couple years with her own lyricism and writing in verse. She writes memoir and fiction and children's books, and she's known for her spare writing style and also for packing a lot of meaning into not a whole lot of words. And that's why we're talking about making your words matter and about poetry and how poetry's very form necessitates spare writing. But it's interesting, Grant, because poetry also has a really problematic reputation in the world of publishing. It's seen as very esoteric, I guess, and therefore not mainstream. And I think a lot of people, especially in the industry, believe that people don't read poetry, even though I wonder about the degree to which that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And one review of Jacqueline's Brown Girl Dreaming, which is a memoir told in verse, as I said, said that readers will fall in love with her language and they may even forget that they're reading poetry. And I think it's meant to be a selling point or a point of praise, but it also just reiterates this idea that poetry itself is not a positive. So what do you make of that, Grant? And what's your own relationship with reading or writing poetry?
Yeah, good question. I love poetry. I love pondering poetry, both in terms of its appeal to writers and readers. And I also like to think about the commercial conundrums around it, as you mentioned. You know, years ago, I read that more Americans write poetry than read it, which is kind of disturbing to me. But on the other hand, I think that it's wonderful because poetry is this really accessible, inviting form to people, and it speaks to them. And my guess is, Brooke, that most of the writers you work with have written poetry. Most memoirists have. And I'm pretty sure that most of the novelists I work with likewise have written poetry. So it's this really common genre. And I was thinking that the probably one of the dominant forms of creative writing that kids grow up with also is like writing poetry in the classroom. And that's partly just because writing a poem fits into the time allotted for class period, but it also, you know, teaches kids so much. So the appeal for engaging in poetry as a way to find meaning and shape meaning is present in most of us in a very fundamental way. And I'm personally always reading a book of poetry alongside my other reading because it expands me in ways other reading doesn't. I see the world at a slant, as Emily Dickinson so famously put it. And I advise writers to engage with poetry as readers and writers because it sensitizes you to language and rhythm and mood in a way that other forms can't. You know, poets put so much pressure on their language in a variety of different ways. So I think one of the best ways to sharpen your prose is to read and write poetry. But yeah, as you mentioned, you know, they say poetry doesn't sell, but I wonder how true that really is. Poetry on Instagram has really changed things. The poet Rupi Kaur, I think that's how you pronounce her name, has millions of Instagram followers, and she's literally sold millions of books, which is amazing for a poet. And in fact, I read that 12 of the top-selling poets were Instagram poets, so maybe there's a way for people to engage with poetry because of its newly found accessibility, rather than the way it's often marketed as something for high-minded literati and academics. I know I follow a bunch of poets and poetry magazines on my Instagram, and it's great getting the poems while I'm scrolling or doom scrolling through my posts. So
I love that term, doom scrolling. I just heard that recently and I'm like, oh, that's what I've been doing. Good to know.
Yeah.
I have been seeing that. Obviously, we've talked about this on this podcast, you know, the poetry on Instagram and this newfound way of getting poetry out into the world. And I do think it's really important. I think what's happening in the world of traditional publishing is that there are just these very few celebrated poets. And then there's these big concrete walls thrown up in every which way for poets who are trying to get their work out into the world. And so it's this strange conundrum that we're facing. You know, it's not so different from memoir, which is like there's these, you know, a lot of desire to have best-selling memoirs and poetry, but then a lot of pushback if you're trying to put your work out into the world in that way. So I think about the fact that, you know, there are all these poets that we all know and we've read, but they're long dead, right? Like Rumi and Emily Dickinson, E.E. Cummings and Pablo Neruda and others who have passed more recently, like Mary Oliver and Maya Angelou. But then to break into poetry, I mean, that's a whole other ball of wax, right? So with Instagram, I mean, some people have said that those poets are saving poetry, but I think what they're really doing is just modernizing it, you know, and that's probably one of the greatest gifts they're giving to the genre. But I think part of what's happening with poetry is that suffers from a bit of a branding problem, in all honesty. But the whole subject is interesting to me, both in the way that our culture, and this is also just publishing in general, we've talked about this a bit as well, you know, that this intersection of celebrating and disdaining at the same time, which is really confusing to writers. I don't know if readers experience that quite to the degree that writers do, but I do think that this is kind of a unique thing to the arts, and that it has something to do with elitism and keeping things rarefied and difficult. So honestly, you know, I'm in the industry and that's the only sense I can make of it.
I agree, Brooke. You know, and sometimes as a writer, I actually have to retreat from all of the industry stuff and just take comfort in the writing itself. And my guess is that Jacqueline might be similar. I'm very intrigued by her writing process, how she has very stringent needs for solitude and quiet to do her writing. And after her partner and daughter and son leave for the day, she closes the door to her office so she can be alone with her work. Even her dog must stay outside so as not to disturb her concentration. And in my dog, by contrast, sits on my lap under my laptop and definitely disturbs my concentration from time to time. And Jacqueline also has a somewhat mystical sense of creativity. She compares the writing process to pregnancy. You know, a story seeds and gestates and takes the form in the author's psyche before being delivered onto the page. And that metaphor works literally because she's birthed 30 works of fiction, poetry, and nonfiction for children and young adults in the last 25 years. And that's another thing that's really interesting to me about her. She crosses genres like very few writers, and she writes so prolifically at the same time. And yet she's not a planner. She says she just lets the characters speak to her and guide her through a story, which is a good lesson for NaNoWriMo writers, I think, no matter if you're a planner or a pantser. You know, if you're a planner, I think you always have to listen to your characters and be open to changing your plans. And then if you're a pantser, what better way to proceed than by starting each writing session in conversation and listening to your characters? In fact, anytime any writer gets stuck in a novel or a memoir, I'd advise having a conversation with your characters like Jacqueline does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's so cool to hear about other writers' processes. You know, when you're working on something, and it's really difficult sometimes to know what you need. And you might sometimes be allowing for things to be okay when they're really not okay, like the degree to which you might be distracted or distractible. And so much of being stuck is really just about some outside force giving you a sign that you need to change things up. So my most general advice ever is this: be open to change.
Yeah, definitely. Be open to change and be open to the invitation to write. And I'm going to give you that invitation now. NaNoWriMo is just around the corner. So sign up to write your story at NaNoWriMo.org. It's free and you have nothing to lose and you'll gain your story. So with that, let's cut to our break and we'll meet you back here to have a little time with the incredible Jacqueline Woodson. Hey, everybody. I thought I'd remind you that Brooke's Memoir Bootcamp, Elevate Your Memoir, starts this week, September 22. It's a 6-week course where you can exercise your memoir muscles with 6 incredible instructors, including today's guest, Jacqueline Woodson, who will be anchoring the Memoir Bootcamp with a class called Memoir as Poetry. I want to take that. This is a not-to-be-missed event. 6 weeks, 6 amazing teachers, held together by Brooke and Linda Joy Myers, who are 2 of the best memoir advocates I know. So check out all the details. And who doesn't need a boot camp? I know I do. In fact, you know, National Novel Writing Month is a type of boot camp. But you can find out more about this one at magicofmemoir.com. Hope you sign up.
All right, everybody, we're back with Jacqueline Woodson, and Jacqueline is the award-winning author of the New York Times bestselling memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, which won the National Book Award, the Coretta Scott King Award, the Newbery Honor, and the NAACP Image Award. She's also the author of Red at the Bone, Another Brooklyn, and dozens of books for young readers. You can find out all about her at jacquelinewoodson.com. So hi, Jacqueline, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, hey, Brooke, it's great to be here.
So I watched your TED Talk, and a lot about it struck me as important for writers to watch. But in particular, there was this little line where you talked about realizing that your story was older and bigger and deeper than you were or than you are. And I love this because it tethers you to your past and to the universal and to the depths that I think really can only be reached through the written word. So I want to start by asking you if you could share more about that and how you might expand on this idea of your story and other people's stories being older and bigger and deeper than they are.
Well, I think the first and foremost, when I was giving that talk, when I was writing that talk and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting, I had to think about why I read slowly and really kind of come to terms with that. And then thinking about how I read as a slow reader, I became a writer. It made so much sense to me that I didn't just wake up one morning and I'm Jacqueline Woodson, the writer, that the fact that the stories I am telling come from someplace way before my own existence, and that having context and having a sense of the history in which the canon of my own writing comes through, I felt like I needed to talk about that and realize yet again that no one writes in a vacuum.
That's so interesting, Jacqueline. I love the idea that our stories are bigger and older than we are, that they have a mystery we can't, you know, in some ways truly fathom. And it reminds me of a metaphor I've heard you mention, that writing a novel is like birthing a baby. And I've also heard you say that you don't outline a novel, but you simply listen to a character and follow their story. So I was wondering, can you talk more about your writing process, especially since so many of our listeners are getting ready to write novels?
Yes, it's always, for me, character driven. So I have a character in my head or an idea of a character. I have the voice of a character, so I know the way they speak. And I don't know what they want. I don't know how they're going to get it. I don't know half the time why I'm the conduit for this story. But I trust the process, and I know that that's where everything begins, right? With that character that has something they want. And I don't outline because I never know where the story's going, and I don't want to beat myself up with an outline. And that's not to say that outlining is wrong or bad or that it doesn't work beautifully for some people. But I know for myself, because my story is so organic and because it's so character driven, I kind of trust that process and let the character kind of take me where I'm going. And of course, it gets to that point where I have to start researching and investigating and scaffolding, but that comes way later.
Well, Jacqueline, I listened to Alicia Keys reading part of your memoir, the chapter called Gifted, and it brought me to tears, actually. People can find that on your website, and it's so powerful to hear it out loud, and I hope listeners will go find it and listen. But Alicia captures something about memoir more broadly when she praised your writing. She said that it was just amazing how it took a big idea and made it simple and something that you could personally relate to. So could you talk about why this is so important for writers to grasp, you know, why it matters to take a big idea and make it simple and relatable?
It's a good question. I think a lot of times we make the mistake of thinking that we need to talk about something huge and universal and something that lots of people can relate to from the onset. And I think it's really important to go to the very specific and then move out from there. So you're not just navel gazing, right? You're looking at this very specific moment and then contextualizing it. And I think what Alicia was reading from was Brown Girl Dreaming, when I was talking about my sister who was considered gifted, quote unquote, as a child, and what that looked like from the perspective of someone, me, who was ungifted, quote unquote. And I think that's something that everyone can see themselves inside of. And for me, it was that very specific memory of that I brought to the page that allowed people to see themselves inside of. So I'm not thinking about the reader. I'm not thinking about this idea, this huge idea that lots of people are going to understand. I'm thinking about this idea that I'm going to understand. And I know if I understand it, if I make it clear on the page for myself, then it will be clear to lots of other people.
It's almost a paradox, you know, that the small moments actually do touch people in a more specific way. And you have talked about that. I've seen in some of the interviews about the small moments. So do the small moments matter no matter what your form?
Definitely. I mean, whether you're writing memoir, novels, or poetry, or, you know, screenplays, it's all about the small moments that chain together to make this huge narrative.
Well, Jacqueline, I'm going to talk a little bit about writing spaces, because I think that that's a good way for people to get ready to write novels as well, especially in these times of the pandemic. And I've read that you have a writing room in your house in Brooklyn, and I love that you call it that rather than an office. Mm-hmm. And then you sometimes write outside on the stoop or in Prospect Park. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about what your writing is like now that we're in this time of COVID. And honestly, I hear so many writers grappling with writing in this time where we seem to face a new crisis each day.
Yeah.
I'm curious, is where and how you write different these days? And do you feel like writers need a room of their own, like Virginia Woolf suggested?
Thanks for that question, Grant. I am actually up in Brewster now.
Oh, okay.
And it's very quiet because my family has gone back to Brooklyn, but I'm actually heading to Brooklyn right after this interview. And here, you know, there's lots of land. There are lots of different spaces to step into and write. And it doesn't matter. Right. It doesn't matter if I have 4 acres or if I have a room in a brownstone in Brooklyn or if I have a bathroom I can go to. What I have that brings me my salvation and the whole family is a mess if I cannot find them are my headphones. And when I put my headphones on, I've disappeared from the world. And there could be 20 people around me and I'm completely unaware of them. You know, I plug in my music, it's pretty much the same soundtrack all the time. And it changes a little depending on the period of time I'm writing in. But it's a way for me to kind of erase the world outside. I also am so, I want to say neurotic, but I stay away from social media. I stay away from the news. I really do a lot of self-care around the information that's coming in from the world all day long, every second of the day. And when I need to get some news, I'll get my partner to tell me what she knows. But I'm very, very clear about protecting my writer self. And I think with the world changing as quickly as it is changing, with the pandemic, with the revolution, so much, but with the election, so much going on, it's very easy as a writer to say, you know what, not today, or forget it, or what's the point of this? And I don't want to do that. So I put those earphones on, I could be sitting in the living room with a bunch of people, or I could be back in Brooklyn, wherever I am. And it also, it's a signal to my family to not bother me. So I use it in two ways.
I've got to get some headphones.
Yeah. It's also great, you know, for when I used to fly, like half the time I don't have anything going on in them. But when you put on headphones, people stop talking to you. And that's great.
Strategy 101. Yeah, thank you. I have a question about spare writing. You know, you're known for, obviously your memoir is memoir in verse. You write a lot in verse. You're known for making your words matter. I did want to read this little excerpt from the New York Times review of Brown Girl Dreaming because I loved it. It says you can read Brown Girl Dreaming in one sitting, but it is as rich as a spread at the potluck table at a family reunion. Sure, you can plow through the pages, grabbing everything you can in one go, like piling a plate high with fried chicken and ribs, potato salad and cornbread. And yes, it's entirely possible to hold that plate with one hand while balancing a bowl of gumbo and sweet tea with the other. But since it's not going anywhere, you may as well just pace yourself. I just thought that was actually a great way of thinking about your work because it is short. You can read it in one sitting. But I wanted to ask you about your intentionality and making words matter. And yeah, just whatever you want to say about that, specifically to a lot of our listeners are writers, you know, mm-hmm. and what you can say to them.
I think it's really important to, you know, respect the narrative. And just because there's a lot of white space on the page, just because something is written in a certain way doesn't mean it should be read in a certain way. And I think I always kind of wince when people say, I read your book in one sitting, or I read your book in an hour, or I read your book in a day. It's like, it took me years and years to get to that kind of language, to pare it down to the essence of the narrative and to what's happening between the lines. So, and I think for me, writing that way is to say, savor this language, read it slowly, take your time with it, try to get to the innuendo, the unsaid parts of it. You know, there's, yes, I distill it, and there's a reason I distill it. So I don't believe in writers reading quickly. I mean, this is what I was talking about in the TED Talk. Like, if you're going to be a writer, you have to be a very engaged reader. You have to deconstruct the language. You have to really study how authors do things. You know, if an author makes you cry, go back and read that passage where you teared up four times to see what words did she use to get you to that. And so I do have a deep, deep respect for language, for writers, for the way words sit on the page, for the, even the, aesthetic of the words on the page. And it takes me a long time to get rid of those adjectives to get to that point where the writing is more of a feeling than, you know, just a straight narrative.
Well, Jacqueline, I'm going to loop back to these headphones one more time, kind of on a tangent. You know, so many writers obviously talk about writer's block a lot. I think it's probably the number one or two topic among writers in interviews like this. And one thing I find interesting is that writer's block sometimes isn't defined. It's just kind of out there, like everybody knows what it is. But I heard you say that writer's block is really about fear. And I think it's really great to place it in an emotion like that. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about why you define writer's block as fear, and, you know, what tips you might have to help people get over that fear, which can take so many different forms and be really deep.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe in writer's block. I think of it as an excuse. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm with you.
If you want to write, you're going to write. You know, I also think, okay, is it writer's block or are you not a writer? I'm sorry. Like, if you are a writer, you will find a way to get that story on the page, or that poem on the page, or that article on the page, or that essay on the page. And it's a question to ask deeply. Why are you writing? Why are you writing this right now? Why does this matter? What are you afraid of? And I always say, you know, when you read it out loud, read what you're writing out loud to yourself alone, and hear it in the world, and hear its magic in the world, and hear its necessity in the world, and then keep writing. But I don't know. I call me a mom. I have very little patience for people whining about not being able to write. Like, there's no excuse, especially now. I've talked often about how there's the saying, if you survive kindergarten, you have enough to write about for the rest of your life. So there's no reason, if you're living in this world, if you're engaged in this world, if you're reading, if you're watching the world and engaging with other people, there's no reason you shouldn't have anything to write about. If you're thinking, like, you should be able to write. So that's my theory behind it. So again, you can see where I lose patience.
Amen. Seriously. No, it's great. And I think people need to hear it. So I'm going to ask you one last question here, because you're going to be teaching a class in my memoir boot camp, which is coming up real soon. And you're teaching memoir as poetry. So I wondered if you could speak a little bit more broadly to this idea of memoir as poetry. As I said earlier, and people know, your memoir is in verse, but I'm wondering where you see the intersection of memoir and poetry.
That's a good question. In what we talked about earlier, and the fact that when we're writing memoir, we're writing about these small moments, and truthfully, when we think about memory does not come to us as a linear narrative, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. It comes to us as these small moments, and there's this white space around them. And that white space is often the unknown. And so that's why it makes sense to me to see memoir as poetry. And also the fact that we're going to revisit again and again and again to get to what it's trying to say. Because memoir is also not just about navel gazing, right? It's about taking memory and doing something bigger with it, relating it into the context of a greater good and a bigger world. And so all of that makes sense to me in terms of why the poetic form works best for it.
That's perfect. It brings us full circle to the universal and the simple and how to figure all that out. So thank you, Jacqueline. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Brooke. Thanks, Grant.
Thanks again, Jacqueline.
Take care.
We will be right back with today's book talk.
This week's book pick is Jacqueline Woodson's own Brown Girl Dreaming. And this memoir is incredible. It's a few years old at this point, but really worth going back and revisiting. I knew it was a memoir in verse, and still when I picked it up, it just blew my mind. And as Jacqueline said in her interview, it's not meant to be read in one sitting. It is a book of poetry, and yet at the same time, a sustained narrative. Every single entry has so much meaning layered. And when you hear how passionate she is about taking it in slowly, it just makes you want to read it that much more slowly. In fact, listening to her made me want to read it again. I hope you pick it up. It's the kind of book that you want to actually buy. It's not the kind of book that you want to read on your Kindle. So I hope you will. And I hope you'll take an opportunity to spend more time with me and Jacqueline at the end of October in the boot camp as well. So thanks so much.
Thanks, Brooke. And just to remind people, we are doing a whole series of podcasts leading up to NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, in November. So expect other special guests giving their novel writing secrets, their tips for ultimate success. Let's put it that way. And so thanks so much for tuning in. And we hope you keep tuning in and keep writing. And you can find this podcast just about anywhere you can find podcasts on the internet. So please subscribe and leave us some comments and reviews and stuff like that. Thanks a lot. And we'll see you next week.